Hi, I'm Bradley Tusk from our studio on Park Avenue South in New York City. This is Firewall. I've got a really great guest today, Mike Dudas, who's the CEO and founder of The Block. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So give the listeners who don't know what The Block is a quick description.
Absolutely. So The Block is a collection of insights, analysis, information, and media about the cryptocurrency and blockchain ecosystem. We looked at the landscape about a year ago, and we felt as if it was just a ton of informational noise, and there really weren't a number of reasonable, dedicated media outlets that people could trust. We saw CoinDesk and a handful of others that were TechCrunch-like. Mainstream media does not have a good grasp of cryptocurrency. You know, Bloomberg, Fortune, others just don't cover it with the expertise necessary. So people were getting their information on Twitter, on Telegram, on Slack. And some of that information is good, but a lot of it is really bad. And you know, as we saw over the past year, retail lost a ton of money. Even professional folks lost a lot of money. And our aim moving forward, you know, we launched 3 months ago, is to bring professional quality, consistent, trusted, transparent information without bias to this ecosystem that desperately needs it, and to make it accessible to all.
So you launched at a time when all of a sudden crypto hit this peak and then started declining. And there's two different points of view on this. I think I know which one you'll say, but I'm curious. One would be the crypto skeptic saying, see, it was all bullshit, you know, it's already all gone. And the other would be, and I think this would include us as investors in the sector, let's shake out all the nonsense, all the pretenders, all the ICO scammers. You know, in some ways, if it's less attractive, the people who really have value to add to the ecosystem and build things are the ones who will stick with it. And therefore, there's no impact on the long-term perspective at all. I'm assuming you're in the latter camp of that.
I am. Yeah. I am. It's funny that you mentioned that peak for I wrote a blog post called Day One, you know, sort of copying Jeff Bezos. And I believe it was written when Bitcoin was at 17,000 and something.
Oh, so you're the reason it fell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know it. January 17th of this year. And everything's gone downhill since then from a price perspective. But to your point, from a building perspective, from a institutional infrastructure perspective, from a authenticity and making sure that you know the folks who are working day in and day out and that you're communicating with are committed and aren't going to run, are in the bunker with you for the long run, that has definitely over the last year, as prices have gone down anywhere from 70% to 95%, helped to weed out sort of the pretenders and the money chasers. And so I liken it to industries and ecosystems I've participated in the past, the biggest one being mobile commerce. So I was working on Google Wallet as head of mobile partnerships and working with retailers in 2010. I mean, this was literally 4 to 5 years before Apple Pay was introduced. And the market did take off when that wonderful product that hit product market fit arrived. But Google, by the way, never quit. Google Pay exists today and will be, I believe, as large, if not larger, given the number of people using Android devices, than Apple Pay in the long run. I think you're going to find some incredible entrepreneurs who are sort of the Googles of the mobile payments and mobile commerce market. And we see those, and we can talk about some of those companies over the rest of the chat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it feels like as a VC, I get an endless number of unsolicited pitches that somehow include like an ICO or some sort of token sale in there. And now you're like, okay, none of this stuff is real.
I mean, I raised a $2 million convertible note, traditional round of funding. Yeah. And I probably talked to 100 different firms and individuals who invest in these types of rounds. And it was incredible the percentage of people who passed literally because I wasn't going to include a token. This is back when they were hot in Q2 of this year in the offering. And they're like, we only invest in tokens. And I think those folks now, they're either out of business
or real equity. Yeah, exactly. So your choice in some ways probably strikes some people as curious in that you're a guy with a lot of operations experience. Yeah. You're an entrepreneur. You enter this industry that is, you know, I think ultimately sort of skyrocketing regardless of the price of Bitcoin at a given moment, but you did it in the guise of a media company, not as a traditional kind of crypto, here's how you will use money in different ways companies. What made you choose to do that?
Yeah, so I looked at the landscape. I did not know how I was going to enter it when I decided to leave the last company I co-founded, Button. And after spending, as you said, you know, 10 years operating mobile commerce companies in sales, business development, marketing roles. What I did know is that my passion for this ecosystem was so large that I had to be in it. And I was fine leaving and then figuring out what I wanted to do. I had invested in 2013 when I was at Braintree and met the Coinbase team and, you know, spoke with Balaji, who I went to college with and who's just such an interesting person, now the CTO of Coinbase. My first investments were via Coinbase. They're an investor in the company, the block, and I owe a lot to them. And I felt as if it was a movement. In other words, I'd worked for a ton of fintech companies, Braintree, Venmo, again, Google Wallet, and the outcomes that you see with so many of these companies in every sector of finance is they get co-opted by the big banks, right? The end goal is that exit or that IPO to then compete with the traditional big banks and eventually adopt their business model. What was so exciting about cryptocurrency was the first marriage of technology and money. You know, Marc Andreessen basically will say that he wishes this had happened 25 years ago when he was, you know, basically creating the Netscape browser, that they'd baked in a commercial element. So the ability to work in that ecosystem was excited me. And it didn't really matter what I was doing. I just wanted to make sure that it tied to my skills and that I thought I had a high probability of success. And at the time, everything was overvalued. So I looked at investing and I said, heck no. And I decided that information was the big need in the ecosystem.
As things now shake out in the sector, both in terms of the types of approaches people are taking or even specific companies, what do you like and what do you think is kind of a fad that's gone in 6 months?
So I'm really excited right now, and it's consistent with why I initially became excited in Bitcoin and in cryptocurrency, but protocols, products, and solutions that have to do with money or with making financial processes better. And that means either more accessible, more efficient, cheaper, you name it. But I'm really excited and most excited about people, you know, like the Lightning Labs team or like Starkware, who are working on financial products or, you know, in the case of Starkware, security solutions. And I'm, when you think about consumer products, the consumer products that excite me are the ones that are really taking analogies from traditional business models. Like my last company, Button, is a very large mobile affiliate company that works with Uber and other great companies. Sure. There's a company called Lolli, L-O-L-L-I, founded by, you know, somebody who's worked in the affiliate space, but that rewards people with Bitcoin. So introducing people to cryptocurrency, I like the consumer-facing products that introduce people to what is a really complex set of technologies in a very friendly way.
So what do you think societally would need to happen for more and more people to sort of accept that introduction? Like, I don't know if you saw last week, the state of Ohio became the first state to start taking tax payments in Bitcoin. Yeah. What things like that would you, if you can wave a magic wand, would you want to see happen?
So the Bitcoiners or the crypto anarchists will get mad at me for this.
that's good. Say it.
and I have tremendous respect for them. I mean, they've formed many of my opinions, and they're not a they're not sort of a body that shares all the same viewpoints. They're diverse, but what I would say is that it really will take, I believe, just having seen previous technologies, the endorsement of large existing organizations, whether that be governments, as you mentioned, a government literally choosing not, you know, absolute scam coin like the Petro in Venezuela, but actually choosing Bitcoin as a currency that the government endorses. It could be a state doing probably more than what Ohio's done, but I like the direction that they're headed in. It will take fidelity or another big company actually putting this asset class, I would call it an asset class,
sure,
into their 401k products and making it a choice, an allocation that the individuals can make. It needs that type of endorsement, in my mind, from traditional financial institutions. The company that I see sort of bridging that gap, one of the most exciting in the U.S., is Square. I'm so incredibly impressed. I mean, total man crush with Jack, obsessed with that company, but I really, really like how Square has basically made this technology and this money understandable and accessible to both their consumer customers and started to bake it into their merchant products.
Right.
How much? And Starbucks, by the way, is potentially going to do that as well.
Yeah.
You know, Howard Schultz is an incredible person who literally led the mobile payments market in the U.S. His endorsement, you know, via the participation and backed of Bitcoin, even if it's converted into fiat the moment they pay, is an incredible endorsement and will get folks day in and day out just dealing with crypto.
There's just nothing more of a mainstream at this point.
You need that endorsement. Yeah, and so many people fight against it. But I think the ship sailed on fighting that tide. It's clear that we need that next level of adoption to get people involved enough using these tokens and these cryptocurrencies to get the interest level back to a point where there will be demand for them.
How much do you think the interests of crypto and blockchain either rise in tandem, or how much are they just really two totally different things that everyone just confuses?
So, you know, you can't separate the two when it comes to true public, you know, cryptocurrencies, right? So when you speak about Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, Zcash, you can't separate, you know, the token from the blockchain itself. I mean, so we won't spend 10 minutes going through that.
Yeah, right.
But when you talk about, I view, for example, permissioned distributed ledgers, what many would call kind of enterprise blockchain, as a separate class of technology that I personally do find very interesting.
Yeah.
And particularly if you take something, I've sold to CIOs, you know, and I don't mean chief investment officers, I mean, you know, information officers at big companies, retail companies. And if it takes a sexy word like blockchain to get these folks to implement efficiency solutions and things that will save them money and give better products, reliability to their customers, things like, you know, healthcare transparency, information, the blockchain, I'm all for it, even if it's not a public cryptocurrency. So I would say, you know, that the notion, though, that like the Bitcoin blockchain without the cryptocurrency, I mean, that means nothing.
Right.
That doesn't exist.
You can have blockchain without crypto. You can't have crypto without
blockchain. Yeah, or you just can't be a true public cryptocurrency without having both. In other words, a blockchain that is dependent on the value of the token, like it is in the case of Bitcoin, right? If the value isn't, to greatly simplify, but if the market value isn't increasing, there's not a store of value argument in the long run. If Bitcoin's total market cap stays where it is today, under $100 billion, well, guess what? I mean, there's just simply no way to park significant amounts of wealth there. So the token value does matter as much as the fact that we're producing blocks every 10, you know, a block every 10 minutes.
If you are an investor or you're working solely in blockchain and you're doing health records or property deeds or something that's completely outside of the world of currency, should you align yourself with Bitcoin and crypto, or should you actually try to distance yourself?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's impossible to say that on a blanket statement. You should definitely understand the benefits of, in this case, the way we're talking about blockchain, distributed ledger technology. So a permissioned blockchain or something of that nature. You should definitely make sure to ignore all IBM marketing materials and that company as a whole, and go to a crypto native company, you know, something like, you know, Blythe Masters, Digital Currency, or Digital Asset Group.
Right.
But you really need to go crypto native, even if it's consensus or just talk to experts in the space. I would say there are some non-blockchain native companies like Accenture that are doing more, and SAP that are making efforts to get educated before they overmarket. But I think you should understand the technology before you dismiss it, But you shouldn't make a decision to utilize something because everybody around you is telling you it's great.
Yeah, no, it's funny because I've got this mobile voting thing over the blockchain that I've been working on and trying to create so that people can vote in elections on their phones.
I got an email about it. I shared it. Fantastic. I was very, very interested. Did you hire somebody?
No, so this is I guess put out there. So I was hoping you'd have an idea. I was going to pick your brain afterwards. I'm looking to hire a entrepreneur in residence for our foundation specifically to work on the blockchain.
So I'm going
to
tweet that out again. I'm super excited about it. Look, I've seen all the reasons and the skepticism about blockchain-based voting, but if there's I was a public policy, political science, economics major in college. You know, I'll eventually go into politics post my entrepreneurial career.
Let me know when you do. I'll give you some free campaign.
Trust me, that's why I'm here. Not kidding. So I'm playing. So basically, it's something that's close, near and dear to my heart, and I want to see people who are optimistic about it research it deeply. I think I've heard too much from sort of the people who don't trust government putting their viewpoints out there about blockchain-based.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's funny. I had a meeting earlier this week with our kind of experts and our advisors and trying to make mobile voting happening. And then when the political people stopped talking and the blockchain experts started talking, for a second, it was like, wait, this is a terrible idea. And like, you know, no one should do this. Like, except we just did. We did in West Virginia and it worked, right? So you can talk yourself out of anything.
Yep.
And to a certain extent, right, you just kind of have to push forward and just say, if you believe that society can't continue on the path it's on as a sustainable country over the next 3 or 4 decades, you have to try something.
Of course. I mean, we saw in just the latest elections, and I'll keep this apolitical, but the voting systems did not work. I mean, our voting machines overheated in Florida. If we just look at structurally how we set rules, the gerrymandering going on and being debated now in North Carolina is just, it staggers beyond belief. So, hey, I'm not going to say that if we get to a blockchain-based voting solution in the U.S. and mobile, and you know that there won't be that every effort and pilot will go perfectly, but golly, I mean, things are going really imperfectly right now.
we're
basically recording, recounting, you name it.
So one thing that we spend a decent amount of time on, and you guys obviously cover this a lot too, would be, you know, coming regulations of crypto specifically.
Yeah.
There's some around blockchain, but it's simpler, obviously, from a political standpoint. What's your sense of both? What do you think is really happening right now? And more importantly, if Steve Mnuchin called you and said, Mike, you know, I know we got to do something here. I don't really know what to do. How do we regulate this thing? What would you tell him?
So, of course, everybody's dream who's a proponent and a supporter of cryptocurrencies as an asset class and crypto economics and crypto networks, as Fred Wilson often talks about, would love regulatory clarity much more quickly. Okay. Hey, what is a security and what isn't? Unfortunately, the SEC historically and with respect to cryptocurrency as well has operated as they historically do. They don't make law, right? They simply enforce it. So they're gently issuing very specific, they're giving very specific guidance about very specific things. They're picking off like very obvious cases that are low hanging fruit, and then making statements, but not enforcement actions in many cases. So, you know, my plea to the SEC would be pick an important big target. This is, I believe, this ecosystem and this set of technologies and everything it entails is so big and so important that it has implications, global implications, for the future of money and the future of nation state power. It really seems over the past week that we're entering this really weird and dangerous potential dawning of a Cold War state against China. China is enforcing pretty heavily against blockchain and crypto technology, at least by the letter of the law, but it's always unclear what's actually happening on the ground. Hey, if we can give regulatory, I'm much less concerned about what happens in Europe, and I feel like they'll fumble any lead we give them in regulatory clarity. But I really think if we set precedent by going after one massive, one important blockchain or project, and one that we wrote at the block and have a few times recently written about Ripple and XRP, which, you know, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not qualified to state what is a security or what isn't. And I won't in this conversation, but the statement, you know, there's obviously a class action lawsuit against Ripple Corp right now. And I would think it's really important. I think the SEC can work to add clarity, to make statements. They can't influence. I mean, they can't make the judgment and they can't impact explicitly what happens in the courts, but they could give guidance and thoughts, because they're doing it about Ethereum, about Bitcoin, and about other protocols. It would be helpful if they did that in the case of Ripple, because now you have Stellar, now you have EOS, you know, Tezos, a number of the biggest blockchains out there have done ICOs, and you literally have, you know, the majority of the non-Bitcoin and non-Ethereum crypto ecosystem basically sitting with massive uncertainty, everything from people building on the protocols to the creators, to the investors, to the promoters, scared. I mean, are they going to have to give money back? You know, like some of the recent folks, like, what was it, Paragon and AirFox. So it's a more clarity, more quickly. You know, people are putting their necks on the line to innovate and really, I think, change the world for the better, the financial world. I'd love it if the SEC stuck their neck out, but I'm probably wishing.
No,
this is like wishing to the tooth
you
fairy.
May have, yeah, sure, but you may have just come up with the narrative that could actually force the action, right? Which is, so we know the Congress is not going to come up with anything, because even
no
when
chance.
It was, right, they couldn't do it when one party controlled both chambers. Now, forget it, right? Now, the SEC and Treasury generally tends to have as much or as little power as they want to say they do, right? If they want to regulate something, they have broad discretion. If they don't, oh, we're waiting for Congress. It seems like they've been pretty cautious because they're not really quite sure where to go. But no one, until you just did now, has framed, at least to me, in the notion of, in the Cold War between the U.S. and China, if we want to advance, if you want to use Trump's terminology, if you want to put America first, we have to take these steps. It's a national security issue.
Every other area, we're doing that. And it's very interesting how hard, you know, they're coming out against technology, right? And you know, I think it's thawing a little bit, but certainly not with respect to new money technology and things that sort of threaten this government. It will be really fascinating. I mean, I remember Pompliano as a joke used to tweet at Trump about Bitcoin, but like, I could actually see this guy. He's crazy enough, like, tweeting about Bitcoin
sure.
and being like, "Hey, my Treasury Secretary won't print as much money as I want. All right, what can we do with this Bitcoin thing?"
And by the way, what's interesting is you could see Trump and a lot of the candidates on the left in 2020 also, I mean, embracing Bitcoin. I mean, I've, you know, if I were Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or anyone on the far left, I would really be embracing crypto, because it fits their political ideology narrative, and it's a way for them to raise money without taking loans.
So what's hilarious about that is that scares the hell out of the crypto anarchists and the sort of original folks who developed cryptocurrency as something, as a hedge against government control of money and fiat. So yeah, I hope becomes an issue. And look, I'm no economist, but I think, you know, we've seen, we're back to I think down on the year now on the S&P, and it's not looking too sweet for 2019 as we lead up with a number of signals outside of the US. So yeah, money and the economy are going to be issues. And then how do we innovate our way out of this? And I think, you know, reinventing how we think about money is a really big talking point that I think everybody's going to try to co-opt, as you said, but in different ways from the left.
Yeah, and there's different, right. Yeah. It's one of the things that won't break up totally Republican Democrat. It's really going to be kind of where in that ideological spectrum you fall.
Yeah. If it looks good, if it has momentum, if price is rising, everybody's going to try and own this thing. The talking points around it and what it is will be very different, because again, cryptocurrency is still a belief system. There's no intrinsic value, right?
Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah, totally. It would be interesting to see if there's even available policy talent around crypto to advise the campaigns, right?
There's like not in the Bloomberg world,
I might be the closest thing we have, and I barely scratched the surface, yeah. Right?
Well, I'm willing to get in your ear. So, hey, there's Coin Center. Do you know those folks? They're based in D.C., Niraj, and some other great folks on the team. Peter Van Valkenburg, who testified testified while Noriel was testifying, and presented sort of an opposing viewpoint about why we need to, again, support innovation. But I've been surprised. And by the way, some of the largest exchanges, I think Coinbase as well, I could be wrong, but I think some of the largest companies have actually finally established a lobbying
organization.
Yeah, Coinbase
has a pretty good public policy.
And by the way, what's incredible about this ecosystem is people shit on that. And I'm like, dudettes, like, we've got to start talking to the people who make policy decisions.
Yeah, otherwise, you're always going to be this little gadfly.
You're going to be a cute little edge case thing, and you're not going to be a multi-trillion-dollar market cap money.
So you're a crypto company, but you're also a media company. Given where Mike ended up in the past week, and for the listeners who don't know, you know, the digital media company that people were really excited about, I think at least here in New York, was getting a lot of buzz. But ultimately, the exit was like, what, $5 million, $8 million, something like that.
Yeah.
Right. So what happened there? But more importantly, what does that tell you about the future of the space? And what does it make you choose to do differently?
I'm glad you asked that question. Our team is focused and lean. We are 9 people in 5 time zones, meaning we span the globe to find the absolute expert in each area that we're trying to build on, whether that's research, whether that's analytics, whether it's journalism, or whether it's engineering. Our CTO, Jake McGraw, is my co-founder and a good friend of mine who I've known for a decade. He spent 5 years at Refinery 29. I think he saw some of the same excesses. Refinery 29, much healthier business than Mike, but obviously at times they've had layoffs and whatnot.
Yeah.
His last company, Attention, ATTN, based in LA, a very large company that does social video marketing. I'm sorry, social video and successful company. But again, the model of those companies has been Attention, sponsored ads, things of the nature, and they've raised so much money. I mean, I come from this world where it's a badge of honor to raise tons of money before you've actually proven out that you can be profitable or that you have product market fit. And I think the world is changing, at least at the early stage. The late stage, SoftBank is just rolling around with so much oil money that, you know, it's impossible for some of these companies not to take it. But at the earlier stages, particularly in areas like media, we need to start looking at what do people value and do you have value? So we chose a vertical money that people value tremendously. We were originally going to focus on consumers like a Mike did.
Yep.
And we decided instead to focus on professionals. So, you know, the person who can expense a $500 a year or a $1,000 a year subscription. And the person who, if we bring them 2 insights per year that make them money, it's worth it by a wide margin. So you can't, you know, it's like you can't get fat and happy like Mike did. 2 floors at the World Trade Center. Are you kidding me?
It's funny. I think there's like a world, maybe this is sort of in terrible taste because I love it, but there's almost a World Trade Center startup hex in the sense that every time that I hear about a startup based there, I'm like, hey, it just feels like a terrible idea that you're in such a beautiful
space. Or a big company.
Space.
Condé Nast has like how many floors there that they can't fill now?
Beautiful. But like every time, like what are Juno, like one of these, like, because you know, ride hailing world.
Yep.
I'm like, I was like, first, I'm like,
they
wow,
blew up
that's
like
impressive.
Right after
Yeah. It's like somehow being there is like the symbol of you're not scrappy and lean and you're not running things the right way.
I would say, hey, if you're going to overpay by a little to take a headache off your hands. We are working out of a WeWork. We have tons of flexibility. We've switched offices 3 times. They take care of everything. My last company, you know, we had to clean the toilets. Like, we literally would get leaks at times, like install the internet. hey, WeWork takes care of all that for me. And then we get to focus on the things we specialize in. But hey, we don't have a whole floor at the World Trade Center. So, yeah, there's always a balance there, I think. And then focus, which is Brian Goldberg of Bustle, who bought for discount. Yep. What a really talented individual. I mean, I know when he introduced Bustle, he didn't necessarily do it in the most tactful way, but certainly his business strategy was spot on. Hey, women, female audience is underserved. He nailed that and brought on a very authentic group, sold ads, and he's just gone and rolled and bought other folks from there and been really, really successful.
You mentioned earlier that sort of a lot of traditional business publications just have a really hard time covering, understanding crypto. Who does it well? Who scares you? And, you know, if the Times called you or the Journal called you and said, Mike, how do we do a better job of this? Like, since you wanted to give them advice, what would it be?
So out of the mainstream media, it's not done very well by anybody. Bloomberg should be doing it well, but they have a notable defined bias against Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And it's unfortunate. I mean, Bloomberg Beta, you know, there's a Chinese wall, but they're an investor in the block, and they're wonderful people. And it's a shame that Bloomberg as an organization does not take cryptocurrency as seriously as they should. In fact, Joe Wiesenthal, one of their very senior personalities and columnists, tweeted today that basically nobody's interested in crypto. And that to me is a sign of a bottom. He's dead wrong. And he's not going to live that tweet down. I won't let him. I mean, he's a great guy, by the way, and he's a very, very, very bright individual. But, it just feels like they don't understand it. So what I would say is you have to bring in believers. It's just you can't cover an ecosystem of that level of importance and complexity without believers, because then they will tell you, they're so passionate, what to look for, what positive things to look for. And by the way, the block, we write a lot of negative stuff. It actually makes me uncomfortable right now how much negative stuff we're writing, but it's been a tough year, right? It's been a tough couple months since we started publishing. I can't wait until we can publish much more positive stuff. But unless you have experts, you can't figure out what to write about. And then we have this mix. We have technologists, so people who are actual engineers who have been at hedge funds and other places, who saw the quality of the initial journalism we were doing and then chose to join our team either full-time or part-time. That has added tremendously. Bloomberg can afford, take one of your quant guys off of the terminal and put them into the crypto analysis department and have them start producing some interesting research for your writers. Have them put a Slack channel together and just work and collaborate together. We run our news organization in a way that I know others don't. I can't name the person that we just hired as our interim editor-in-chief, but he's incredible, comes from TechCrunch, and has never seen anything like the level of collaboration. Wigs. Lawn Wigs.
You talk about frontier tech a lot. And what's interesting to me is you're in a world that is sort of very, still fairly niche, right? So you can say things and people, the audience is pretty sophisticated. So therefore they know what you're talking about. When I'm out there talking about tech, I've realized people sort of still have this image in their head, but what company exists today that doesn't use, whoever made the table that we're sitting at used technology to make the table. I mean, there's not a single business around anymore that doesn't use technology in some form. So do you think there needs to be a name for, really new cutting edge ideas? And it can be crypto, but could it be AI or autonomous vehicles or drones? I mean, it doesn't just have to be that. But how do you think people in your world see that? Why have you been using that phrase that way? And where do you think?
Yeah. So the technology industry has become institutionalized in a way, particularly over the past decade. And I tweeted about this recently, but it really hit me over the last, I would say, 2 or 3 years. As you saw, four of the largest companies, including Microsoft, coming back and approaching this $1 trillion market cap situation. And then you have a whole set of other big companies in every vertical. I mean, just the ones I'm familiar with, like Oracle, Salesforce, Adobe, and marketing tech. And the big companies are paying through the nose. I know because they're poaching engineers from companies I've worked at or know at, you know, 1.5 to 2 times the salary plus equity. So, you know, we're in an environment where I think in the 90s, people felt like pirates when they were working at a tech company. If you were at Netscape, if you were at eBay, like, oh my God, like I graduated from Stanford in 2001, which is actually too late, right? Because like we were right in that crash. Yeah. So it would have been better to graduate in 97 or 2005. I was right in that shitty time. I ended up at Disney and it was very fortunate to be at a great company and learn discipline, but bored to death by the spreadsheets I was building there. Anyway, the pirates of let's just say the 90s, again, have become, you know, now tech, Facebook and Google, they're finishing schools, right? It's like you go to school and then you get recruited out of the engineering CS department that teaches you nothing practical at Stanford, and you end up at Facebook or Google where you just optimize somebody else's code for about 2-3 years. And then if you have a little courage, you go out and you work at Airbnb. And then like by the time you're 30, like maybe you take a risk. There's another group of people. We found some of them, even though we don't seem like a deep tech company. Most of our team is under 25 and they're people who just have passion. They're not following. By the way, I'm making light of that kind of systemic following. I mean, like I said, I went to Disney, I went to business school. Like I wasted 5, 6, 7 years at the beginning of my career. It's why I'm going to turn 40 this year. And you know, this is the first time I've been CEO of a company, right? Like it took a long time. And so I think in frontier tech is something that it should be painted as exciting. That's where the innovation's happening. There is gobs, just ungodly gobs of money sitting on balance sheets out there from, you know, high net worth individuals, sovereign. I mean, you know this as well as anybody, you know, $1.5 trillion plus that is going to be plugged in. There's no shortage of money to back people willing to work on exciting things. You don't need to be a founder necessarily, but go take a risk and join that experienced person who's raised money and is working on a problem that you love, because it's so much lower risk to work in what I like to call frontier tech than people believe. People don't ding you for working on interesting problems anymore.
Even if you fail.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's also just actually lower risk to work on something that you really enjoy, because, okay, so maybe the ROI economically, you know, on any one of them has a lower odds simply because of the higher risk. But ultimately, like, you develop skills, you like what you do, you're happy.
You meet great people versus you go, and I'm not going to name it, just in crypto itself. So many people have gone to these big brands and you know, Consensus, for example, laid off 13% of their staff today. So, you know, some of these brands that you go to, you think they're the best thing on earth, but actually, you know, they're a chain that holds you back. Now, Consensus, I'm not saying it is. Consensus has some fantastic people. But again, nothing in life is certain. And that probably would have been the last company 6 months ago that you would have said, I might get laid off in the next 12 months. So I think people overestimate certainty in some of these bigger entities and underestimate the adventure, the learning in some of the smaller companies. So frontier tech, it's a term I use. Yep. I love it. Because particularly in crypto, we are in the Wild West, not a lot of regulation. We like to say at the block, like we're the sheriffs, we're coming in, we're trying to spot the frauds and the scams. But we also, you know, want to hold up and support and enforce the rights of the really good companies, the Coinbases and the other ones.
Cool. So work in frontier tech and don't waste your time on business school.
Absolutely get nowhere near a business school. And if you have any second questions about that, direct message me at mdudis on Twitter.
Yeah, I'll add law school to that mix too. All right, Mike Dudis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bradley. Cool. Appreciate it.
So I wrote a book, The Fixer, My Adventure Saving Starts with FI Politics. It's available today at bradleytush.com and at your local bookstore.